The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I am pleased to see all of you here and to introduce our guest this evening. As Charles Dickens wrote in his novel Hard Times, there is a wisdom of the head and a wisdom of the heart. Our speaker tonight is proficient in both. Dr. Sandeep Jahar earned a PhD in experimental physics at UC Berkeley before going on to study medicine at Washington University in St. Louis. He is currently a practicing cardiologist as well as the director of the heart failure program at Long Island Jewish Medical Center. As if that weren't enough to make any mother proud, he is the author of two best-selling medical memoirs, Intern, A Doctor's Initiation, and the highly engaging and candid Doctored, The Disillusionment of an American Physician. Dr. Jahar is a frequent contributor to the Wall Street Journal, NPR, and MSN, as well as the New York Times, where he has written about medicine for more than 20 years. In his latest book, Heart, A History, which the Wall Street Journal calls chattily and wittily erudite, Jahar weaves his own work with historical research and the findings of groundbreaking new technologies to tell the story of our most essential and self-sustaining organ. As Sanjay Gupta writes, along the way, we learn not only the history of the heart, but what we can do to prolong our own heart health. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Sandeep Jahar to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Thank you. Good evening, and it's really such a pleasure for me to be here. I just had a wonderful afternoon in Philadelphia, I'm really pleased to be here, and I appreciate your coming out. So, you know, I would like to talk about my book, but I found that people very often want to know a little bit about me and how I got into writing and medicine, so I'll talk a little bit about that, maybe for about 5 or 10 minutes, and then I'll talk about why this book, why I wanted to write it, and then I will read an excerpt from the book that I think encapsulates many of the themes, just to give you an idea of what the book is about. So that should take about maybe 30 minutes or so. So let me start by talking a little bit about myself. Now, as the writer of two memoirs, I actually don't find this very difficult to talk about what specifically I should say about myself that would interest you. But let me just start quickly from the beginning. So I was born in New Delhi to a father who's a plant geneticist, and he tended to move around a lot. So I had a somewhat nomadic childhood. I lived in New Delhi, spent some time in Wales. We lived in London for a while. We moved back to New Delhi. We eventually moved to the United States, to Lexington, Kentucky. And then from there, we settled in Southern California in a place called Riverside, and that's where I grew up. And when I was growing up, I was always fascinated by the human heart for a number of reasons, which I'll talk about briefly in a couple of minutes. But I was pretty sure I didn't want to be a doctor. And now that didn't sit well with my parents. My parents were immigrants to this country, and they struggled, frankly, to get their footing, both socially and financially. And so, to them, a career in medicine was just the epitome of what one should pursue. And my brother, my older brother, always sort of knew he wanted to be a doctor, but I wasn't quite sure. And even though I was really fascinated by the human body and about the sort of the science of medicine, I wasn't sure if I really wanted to be in practice. When I was growing up in New Delhi, I spent some time with my grandfather, who was a doctor. And although I really appreciated what he did for patients and the role he took in his community, I sort of thought of medicine as somewhat cookbook, and I wanted to do something that I thought might be more creative. So I went to Berkeley, and one day I told my dad I should mention that my father's favorite saying was, non-science is nonsense. So this was like the weird home that I grew up in, where, my choices were somewhat curtailed by my father's attitude. So one day I went to my father and I said, actually I was not going to study medicine, I was going to study physics. And he said, okay, that's fine. So just to give you an idea then of the strange culture I grew up in, rebellion in an immigrant Indian culture was saying no to a career in medicine and then going into physics. That was So anyway, I went to Berkeley, I studied physics, I enjoyed it, and then midway through my graduate training, a dear friend of mine got sick with a disease called lupus. And I knew nothing about lupus, and really, honestly, not too much about medicine. But I knew I wanted to help her, and so I started talking to doctors and going to the library. I had a sort of typical graduate student attitude, which is, that I'm just going to roll up my sleeves and talk to every expert out there and synthesize all the information and figure this out. But what I came to understand, which I'm sure most of you know, and perhaps I did know also in the back of my mind, but I didn't really want to admit it, is that that there are things that are just not understood in science in general, but especially in medicine. There are a lot of mysteries, and that was upsetting, but also strangely attractive to me at the time. And so in the end, I decided that I was going to apply to medical school. And I finished up my graduate training and I applied. So that's how I got into medicine. Now, before I went to medical school, I had a summer free. And so I thought about how I wanted to spend the summer. And I'd always really been interested in writing when I was growing up. But it was never something that I really thought I could pursue, non-science is nonsense sort of thing. So I said, okay. So I thought to myself that I would spend the summer doing journalism, which I'd always really been fascinated in. So I applied for a journalism fellowship, and I got it and went to the Washington, D.C. Bureau of Time Magazine. And I spent the summer there. And it was fantastic. I had a lot of fun. I did things I'd never really would have dreamed of doing when I was in graduate school. I interviewed Bob Dole for my first assignment. That was really fun. And so at the end of the summer, I spoke to the chief of the bureau, and I said, look, I'm going to medical school, but can you give me some names of journalists I might call on in the future? And he said, sure, and he gave me a couple of names. And I said, yeah, that's fine. What about the New York Times? And he said, well, okay, and he gave me a name. And then I went to Washington University in St. Louis, went to medical school, and one day I just on a lark called up the editor at the New York Times. And I'm not sure why I did it. I wouldn't do it today. But I just gave him a call. And he really should have hung up the phone because I had nothing. I had no clips, I had no experience, I'm not even sure why I was calling, but it turns out that he was from St. Louis. And not only was he from St. Louis, but he had lived on the street I was living on. So we had a connection. So we chatted for a while, and then he said, hey, next time you're in New York, give me a call, we'll have coffee. I said, wonderful. Hung up the phone, and I did what any aspiring journalist would do. I called up American Airlines, and I booked a flight to New York. And I flew out there, I think the following week, or maybe 2 weeks later, and I went to his office. And it was, he wasn't quite as friendly in person. But he basically said, kid, I don't know what you're doing here, but you can't work here. You should go back to St. Louis and maybe get an internship at the local paper. I said, okay. So I went back to St. Louis. I somehow was able to scare up an internship at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And I spent afternoons going to the paper, and they would, this is during second year of medical school. We had a great transcription service, so I didn't miss anything. But in any case, I'd walk in, and one of the editors would say, "Hey, you know, there are a bunch of wasps stinging people in Forest Park. Write a story about wasps." And I'd say, "Okay, fine." And I'd go and research whatever about wasps, and I'd call a few experts, and I'd write a story, and it was great, you know, great experience. And and in the end, I got a few clips, and I sent them to the New York Times. And then finally, I graduated from medical school, and I went to New York to do my internship. And right before I started my internship, I pitched a story to the New York Times. They accepted it. They flew me out to a place in Louisiana to research the story, and I wrote it up. And they published it on my second or third day of internship. And they said, look, we know you're not going to be able to do anything reportorial during internship, but you should write about your internship. And they had just started a column called Cases, and I started writing for the Cases column fairly regularly. And in the end, that's kind of what spawned my first book, which was called Intern. My second book was called Doctor, and I'll very, very briefly tell you that it came out of what I sort of appreciated was a kind of midlife crisis in American medicine. When I started my first job as a cardiologist, I was it was 19 years after I graduated from high school. So it was incredibly long ordeal, and I was ready and very relieved to finish all my training, and I was ready to start my job. And I would go to the doctor's lounge, and there were all these doctors who would talk about how terrible it was to be a doctor. And it was really shocking. Now, you know, I wasn't naive to it, but frankly, when you're in training as a doctor, they don't teach you much about the culture of practice. They teach you a lot about physiology or treatments or procedures, but you don't learn too much about what it means to be a doctor. What is the daily practice like? And so so I would listen to these doctors talk, and what occurred to me was that they weren't really complaining so much about the paperwork or money, although that would come up, but the kernel of their dissatisfaction was that they were experiencing what I considered an existential crisis, that they were not allowed to practice medicine the way they wanted to, the way that they had aspired to in their younger days, when they had sort of more, maybe more ideals. And that was very, very upsetting to these physicians. And then ultimately, maybe I spent too much time in the doctor's lounge, but I started to feel disillusioned. And in the end, I wrote my second book, which is also a memoir, called Doctored, about the what I called the midlife crisis of American medicine. So, coming to my third book, Heart, History. So why did I write this book? I had always been fascinated by the human heart since childhood. The grandfather I told you about, who I spent time with, he died of a heart attack. Suddenly, he was talking to his wife, my grandmother, listening to the BBC, and all of a sudden was no more. My paternal grandfather also died of a heart attack. Well before I was born, I never met him. And he died in front of my father, who was not yet 14. And that experience really colored my father's life, really. And by extension, colored our lives too. There was a sort of grief in the home, a low-level grief kind of all the time. Like, my father just never quite got over it. And I came to think of the heart as the executioner of men, mostly men, at least in my family, in the prime of their lives. And I was like fascinated by the kind of paradox of the heart, that it was so vulnerable, and by extension, we, our bodies, are so vulnerable to its function. And yet it's so muscular and so energetic. The heart pumps 3 billion times in a typical human lifetime. And it pumps blood through 100,000 miles of blood vessels. A typical human heart will empty a swimming pool in a week. That's how much work it does. And yet, it can stop suddenly. And so I was just fascinated by this idea and frankly afraid. So I would, like, when I was a kid, I remember lying in bed, looking up at the ceiling fan and listening to the pulse in my ear and sort of timing the pulse with the period of the ceiling fan. You know, it was that kind of thing. I was constantly thinking about, and I'm sure my father's grief had a lot to do with it. But that was one thing that really led to my obsession, was my malignant family history. The fact that I, 35 years later, learned that I myself have coronary disease, and that's in the book, that did nothing to lessen my obsession at all. You know, heart disease is the number one killer in the world and the number one killer in the United States. 18 million people die of heart disease, cardiovascular disease, every year. Even though we've made tremendous progress through the 20th century, that progress has slowed, frankly. There is very good evidence that the rate of decline of cardiovascular death has significantly slowed in the last 5 to 10 years in the United States. And for a while, the thought was that cancer would eclipse heart disease as the number one killer, but that does not, if the trends had continued, but that does no longer appears to be the case. The heart disease graph curve has really flattened. It's no longer in as steep of a decline. So the other thing about the heart is that it's just a fascinating entity. It is an entity that actually poses some unique challenges to doctors. Most people don't realize that as of the late 19th century, the heart had never been operated on. Every other organ in the body had been subject to the human knife, including the brain, but not the heart. Now, the reason why is perhaps evident. The heart has some unique properties that really make it very difficult to manipulate. Number one, it's constantly moving. You can't suture into something that's moving. Okay. Secondly, it's filled with blood. If you cut it open, you're apt to bleed to death within about a minute or so. Now, there are ways to overcome all this, and now we know that the solution is a machine to take over the circulatory function while the heart is stopped. But that machine took a long time to build. It has been called one of the greatest feats of the human mind to build the heart-lung machine. And I talk about that history in the book. But that development was very slow for a number of decades. And it was partly because of the Second World War and the Depression, but it was also because of cultural taboos associated with the heart. The heart was the seat of the soul. It's the repository of the emotions. It seemed to be something more than just an organ. And I think that also significantly slowed progress. So what did doctors do without a heart-lung machine? Well, I talk about some of the fairly outlandish schemes that were devised to operate on the heart. One scheme I'll briefly mention was called cross-circulation. Cross-circulation is probably one of the craziest schemes in the history of medicine, but it stemmed from a very simple observation. There's a guy named Walt Lillehei, who's a surgeon at the University of Minnesota. Many would consider him the most innovative surgeon of the 20th century, definitely the most innovative cardiac surgeon. But he came up with a scheme that was sort of born out of his observation, simple observation, that a pregnant mother provides blood, oxygen, nutrients to her fetus. The fetus doesn't breathe because it's floating in fluid, so it has to receive oxygen from its mother. So Lillehei thought, well, why can't I do that for a person? Why can't I hook up a parent to his or her child? Have the parent's circulation take over the child's circulation while I stop the child's heart, clamp it off, isolate it, drain it of blood, cut it open, suture it, fix, you know, do whatever I need to do, close it up, unclamp, and hope for the best. So he did these experiments initially with his team on dogs. And initially, the dogs all developed brain damage because they didn't really know how to work. They were mistakes that were made in the hookup. And, you know, that's something that I think it's important to acknowledge and something that I do talk about in the book. The fact that in medicine, as much as we might not want to admit it, there's a learning curve. Someone goes first, and someone has to go first. And in Lillehei's case, the patients who went first were, unfortunately, small children with congenital heart defects. Now, Lillehei was an extraordinary surgeon and a very interesting person. He was a cancer survivor. He got a biopsy when he was a resident, and his chief didn't divulge that he had cancer for a couple of months so he could finish his residency. Then his chief operated on him, a guy named Wangenstein, who's one of the great surgeons, and essentially cured him. And Wangenstein always looked at Lillehei as sort of like a son. And he was also convinced that Lillehei would win a Nobel Prize. He, in fact, didn't, but he won sort of the American equivalent, which was the Lasker Prize, for a lot of different work, but also for cross-circulation. So Lillehei did these surgeries, and, well, he proposed doing them. Initially, you can imagine the uproar. People said, this is absolutely insane. This is the first operation in human history that could kill two people. But Lillehei knew that without doing this, these children were condemned to an early death. And so he did these cross-circulation experiments. mainly before the heart-lung machine was developed, and he operated 45 times with cross-circulation with 28 long-term survivors, which was much better than the long-term natural history of congenital heart disease in the 1950s. So history has judged his work to be a success. This is just one example of many in the book that sort of describe what I think is the most fascinating history. The heart is not only a fascinating organ, not only does it do feats that are sort of mind-boggling, like beating 3 billion times, but the history of it is also very fascinating. And I hope that you'll appreciate that if you read the book. The final reason why I wrote the book is the heart is probably the most metaphorized object in human life. It is an organ that's literally fills with metaphor. And that brings me to the extract that I'll read now. And it'll be about 10 minutes, and then we can take some questions. No other organ, perhaps no other object in human life, is as imbued with metaphor and meaning as the human heart. The seat of the soul, the repository of emotions. The word emotion derives from the French verb émouvoir, meaning to stir up. And perhaps it is only logical that emotions would be linked to an organ characterized by its agitated movement. Throughout the years, the symbolism of the emotional heart has endured. If we ask people which image they most associate with love, there's no doubt that the Valentine heart would top the list. The heart shape, called a cardioid, is common in nature. It appears in the leaves, flowers, and seeds of many plants, including silphium, which was used for birth control in the early Middle Ages and may be the reason why the heart became associated with sex and romantic love. Whatever the reason, hearts began to appear in paintings of lovers in the 13th century. Over time, the pictures came to be colored red, the color of blood, a symbol of passion. Later, heart-shaped ivy, reputed for its longevity and grown on tombstones, became an emblem of eternal love. In the Roman Catholic Church, the heart shape became known as the Sacred Heart of Jesus. Adorned with thorns and emitting ethereal light, it was an insignia of monastic love. This association between the heart and love has withstood modernity. When Barney Clark, a retired dentist with end-stage heart failure, received the first permanent artificial heart in Utah on December 1st, 1982, his wife of 39 years asked the doctors, "Will he still be able to love me?" Today we know that the heart is not the source of love or the other emotions per se. The ancients were mistaken. And yet more and more we've come to understand that the connection between the heart and the emotions is a highly intimate one. The heart does not originate our feelings, but it is highly responsive to them. In a sense, a record of our emotional life is written on our hearts. Fear and grief, for example, can cause profound cardiac injury. The nerves that control unconscious processes, such as the heartbeat, can sense distress and trigger a maladaptive fight or flight response that signals blood vessels to constrict, the heart to gallop, and blood pressure to rise, resulting in damage. In other words, it is increasingly clear that our hearts are extraordinarily sensitive to our emotional system, to the metaphorical heart, if you will. There is a heart disorder first recognized about 2 decades ago called Takotsubo cardiomyopathy, or the broken heart syndrome, in which the heart acutely weakens in response to extreme stress or grief, such as after a romantic breakup or the death of a spouse. Patients, almost always women for unclear reasons, develop symptoms that mimic those of a heart attack. They may develop chest pain and shortness of breath, even congestive heart failure. On an echocardiogram, the heart muscle appears stunned, frequently ballooning into a distinctive shape that resembles a Japanese octopus trapping pot called a Takotsubo. Though we don't know exactly why this happens, the syndrome often resolves within a few weeks. However, in the acute period, it can cause heart failure, life-threatening arrhythmias, even death. The first studies of this disorder were on victims of emotional or physical trauma who seemed to die not from their injuries, but from cardiac causes. Autopsies showed telltale signs of heart injury and cell death. The broken heart syndrome can even occur when patients are not conscious of their grief. The husband of an elderly patient of mine had died 2 weeks prior. She was sad, of course, but accepting, maybe even a bit relieved. It had been a long illness. He'd had dementia. But a week after the funeral, she looked at his picture and became tearful. And then she got chest pain. And with it came shortness of breath, distended neck veins, sweaty brow, a noticeable panting while she was quietly sitting in a chair, all signs of congestive heart failure. When we did an ultrasound, her heart had weakened to less than half its normal function. But nothing on other tests was amiss. No sign of clogged arteries anywhere. 2 weeks later, her emotional state had returned to normal, and so had her heart. Takotsubo cardiomyopathy has been reported in many stressful situations, including public speaking, gambling losses, domestic disputes, even a surprise birthday party. Outbreaks of it have even been associated with widespread social upheaval, such as after a natural disaster. For example, in 2004, a major earthquake devastated a district on the largest island in Japan. 39 people were killed and more than 3,000 were injured. On the heels of this catastrophe, researchers found that there was a 24-fold increase in the number of Takotsubo cases in the district 1 month after the earthquake compared with a similar period the year before. The residences of these cases were closely correlated with the intensity of the tremor. In almost every case, patients lived near the epicenter. The broken heart syndrome has also been studied in the United States. Scientists at the University of Arkansas identified almost 22,000 patients diagnosed with Takotsubo cardiomyopathy in this country in 2011. The highest rate of cases, nearly triple the national average, was in Vermont, where a tropical storm wreaked more damage that year than in nearly a century. The second highest rate was in Missouri, where a massive tornado ripped through the town of Joplin, killing at least 158 people. Though these geographic areas were not the only ones hit by natural disasters that year, the scientists noted that their populations were perhaps less prepared because of a lack of experience with disasters, and thus more vulnerable to the ensuing distress. Interestingly, Takotsubo cardiomyopathy can develop after a happy event too, but the heart appears to react differently, ballooning in the mid portion, for example, rather than at the apex. Why different emotional precipitants result in different shape changes in the heart is a mystery. But today, perhaps as an ode to our ancient philosophers, we can acknowledge that even if our emotions are not located inside our hearts, the biological heart overlaps its metaphorical counterpart in surprising and mysterious ways. Apart from Takotsubo cardiomyopathy, heart problems including sudden death have long been reported in individuals experiencing intense emotional disturbance or turmoil in their metaphorical hearts. In 1942, the Harvard physiologist Walter B. Cannon published a paper called Voodoo Death, in which he described cases of death from fright in people who believed they had been cursed, such as by a witch doctor. Sometimes the victim, all hope lost, dropped dead on the spot. What these deaths had in common was the victim's absolute belief that there was an external force that could cause their demise and against which they were powerless to fight. This perceived lack of control, Cannon postulated, resulted in an unmitigated physiological response in which blood vessels constricted to such a degree that blood volume acutely dropped, blood pressure plummeted, the heart acutely weakened, and massive organ damage resulted from a lack of transported oxygen. Cannon believed that voodoo deaths were limited to primitive people, quote, so superstitious, so ignorant, that they feel themselves bewildered strangers in a hostile world, end quote. But over the years, these types of deaths have been shown to affect all manner of modern people too. Today, death by grief has been observed in spouses, siblings, and even in animals. Broken hearts are literally and figuratively deadly. In my new book, Heart: A History, I describe how the care of the heart has become less the province of philosophers who dwelled on the heart's metaphorical meanings and more the concern of doctors wielding technologies that even a century ago, because the heart's exalted status in human culture, were considered taboo. The great pioneers include Daniel Hale Williams, the African-American doctor who performed the world's first documented open-heart surgery in Gilded Age Chicago, and C. Walton Lillehei, who connected a child circulatory system to a healthy parent's, paving the way for the heart-lung machine. A common theme connecting such discoveries is the transformation of the human heart from an almost supernatural object imbued with metaphor and meaning into a machine that can be manipulated and controlled. But these manipulations, we now understand, must be complemented by attention to the emotional life that the heart, for thousands of years, was believed to contain. Consider, for example, the lifestyle heart trial published in the British journal The Lancet in 1990. 48 patients with moderate or severe coronary artery disease were randomly assigned to usual care or an intensive lifestyle that included a low-fat vegetarian diet, an hour of daily walking, group psychosocial support, and stress management. After a year, the lifestyle patients had a nearly 5% reduction in coronary plaque. Control patients, on the other hand, those who had usual care, had an average 5% more coronary obstruction after 1 year and 28% after 5 years. They also had roughly double the rate of cardiac events, including heart attacks, coronary bypass surgery, and cardiac-related deaths. Now, here's an interesting fact. Some patients in the control group adopted diet and exercise plans that were almost as intense as those of the intervention group. However, their heart disease still progressed. Diet and exercise alone were not enough to facilitate coronary disease regression. At both 1 and 5 year follow-ups, stress management was more strongly correlated with the reversal of coronary artery disease than exercise. Dr. Dean Ornish, the lead author of the study, said this: "The need for connection and community often goes unfulfilled in our culture. We know that these things affect the quality of our lives, but they also affect our survival to a much larger degree than most people realize." Many studies have suggested that Dr. Ornish is right. For example, patients who are depressed after a heart attack are 4 times as likely to die within 6 months as those who are not, irrespective of usual cardiac risk factors like high cholesterol, hypertension, obesity, and smoking. Menopausal women with no history of cardiovascular disease who expressed more hopelessness on a psychological questionnaire had more carotid artery thickening and an older vascular age than matched patients who felt good about their lives. No doubt many of these studies are small. And of course, correlation does not prove causation. It's certainly possible that stress leads to unhealthy habits, and this is the real reason for the increased cardiovascular risk. But as with the association of smoking with lung cancer, when so many studies show the same thing, and there are mechanisms to explain a causal relationship, it seems capricious to deny that one probably exists. What many doctors have concluded is fully consistent with what I too have learned in my nearly 2 decades as a heart specialist. the emotional heart affects its biological counterpart in surprising and mysterious ways. And yet medicine today continues to conceptualize the heart as a machine. That conceptualization has had great benefits. Cardiology has undoubtedly been one of the great scientific success stories of the past 100 years. Heart transplants, pacemakers, coronary bypass surgery, coronary angioplasty, all these things were discovered or invented after World War II. However, it's possible we've approached the limits of what scientific medicine can do to combat heart disease. Indeed, the rate of decline in cardiovascular mortality has slowed significantly in the past decade. An autopsy study suggests that 80% of Americans 16 to 64 years old have at least the beginnings of coronary artery disease. These findings indicate that the four-decade-long decline in heart disease may be coming to a halt. We will need to shift to a new paradigm, one focused on prevention, to continue to make the kind of progress to which we have become accustomed. In this paradigm, psychosocial factors will need to be front and center in how we think about heart problems. Despite the centuries-old association of the heart with emotions, this is still a domain that remains largely unexplored. The American Heart Association still does not list emotional stress among the key modifiable risk factors for heart disease, perhaps in part because blood cholesterol is so much easier to reduce than emotional and social disruption. We need a better way, one that recognizes the power and importance of emotions that the heart, the metaphorical heart, was believed to house for millennia. Today, it is increasingly clear that chronic diseases like hypertension, coronary disease, and heart failure are linked to the state of our neighborhoods, jobs, families, and minds. To treat our hearts optimally will require interventions on all these fronts. This is much easier said than done, of course. Psychosocial repair is just as prone to unexpected consequences, difficult trade-offs, conflicting values, and diminishing returns as any medical treatment. But we will have to find ways, as Peter Sterling, the neurobiologist, has put it, to, quote, reduce the need for vigilance and to restore small satisfactions, end quote, such as our contact with nature and with each other. For some, this will require city planning initiatives to encourage walking or bicycling, for example, instead of more sedentary lifestyles. Others will require fortification in more social realms, such as the enhancement of public life and more book talks. For still others, cardiovascular benefits will come from more individual pursuits, such as meditation and stress reduction. Whatever the case, it is increasingly clear that the biological heart is inextricably linked to its metaphorical counterpart. Our mindset, our coping strategies, how we navigate challenging circumstances, our capacity to transcend distress, all these things I have learned are also a matter of life and death. Okay, so I'll stop there, and thank you very much for coming.
I learned just a couple of years ago of another unusual relationship, and that is the relationship between flossing and heart disease. Could you talk about that a little bit?
You know, there was... This is an association that I think has probably not panned out, but there was some observational evidence that periodontal disease, possibly by causing inflammation, was linked to coronary disease. So the thought was that that flossing might help your heart. As far as I know, there have been no randomized controlled trials to look at this. So we don't know for sure what that link is. You know, it's interesting that observational studies don't always lead to effective treatments. So, for example, we know that patients who have high HDLs, so-called good cholesterol, have a decreased risk of heart disease. However, we also know that taking a pill to increase your HDL doesn't really do anything. In fact, it may be detrimental. So the several trials over the last 5 years or so have been stopped or terminated or published negative results. So the observations don't always lead to an effective treatment, but I encourage you to floss.
I'm wondering about anecdotally in my own family, siblings have seemed to be living with heart disease through medications and good care, presumably. And so what does the record say about the relative longevity of people who have heart disease?
The longevity is has significantly improved. So the average American lifespan increased by 6 years in between 1945 and sort of mid-1960s. Most of that was because of advances in cardiac science. And I talk about this in the book quite a bit, that the number one killer in this country is heart disease. It has been for the past 100 years. The only year that is eclipsed by something else was 1918, I believe, which was the year of the grand influenza pandemic. But other than that, heart disease has been the number one killer. But in the 1940s and 50s, it was a much bigger killer than it is today. In fact, Harry Truman, when he started the National Heart Institute, when he signed the bill, he said that he used language about heart disease that was starkly similar to the language he was using about the Soviets and the Iron Curtain as being, this tremendous enemy, this obstacle to, fruition of American life. People were dying left and right. In fact, I think for a while, the number of deaths in Americans in the 1940s from heart disease approached 1 in 2. Now it's significantly less, but it's still the number one killer. Now, I would say that there have been tremendous advances in survival from heart disease in my lifetime. In fact, when I was born in 1968 happened to be the year where cardiovascular mortality peaked in the United States. Now, subsequently, there was a decline. There was a decline for a number of reasons. Smoking rates dropped. There was a huge public health campaign to decrease cigarette consumption, which was largely successful. Incredible medicines were developed, including anti-cholesterol drugs like statins, and then technologies like coronary bypass, coronary angioplasty, artificial hearts, heart transplants. I talk about all these pacemakers, defibrillators. I talk about all these technologies and how they developed. And what's interesting is that, parenthetically, so much of this was developed by mistake. For example, the first pacemaker was developed by this unassuming engineer in upstate New York who hooked up the wrong resistor to his transistor circuit, and it started pulsing one time a second. And a number of years previously, he had spoken to some surgeons when he was working on a sheep farm in Ithaca, New York, who described the problem of heart block, where the heart electrical current stops conducting from the upper chamber to the lower chamber. And they described the problem and how they wished that there could be an electrical circuit that could sort of control the heart, control the heartbeat. And he figured it, he discovered it, but it was by mistake. So much of this was discovered by mistake. But the progress was indelible. So the mortality from heart attacks, for example, was 30% in 1957. And today it's about 3%. So tremendous, tremendous progress. But the point I try to make in the book is that technologies will only go so far. I mean, in some ways, we're victims of our own success. I mean, how much lower can we go? But a largely unexplored area is the effect of psychosocial stress on our hearts. And we have now, irrefutable evidence that grief, stuff like heartbreak, can affect our hearts biologically. And we need to pay more attention to that.
So the question is very simply, you said just a few moments ago, how low can we go? I think the answer is very low, because there are societies in this world that have startlingly low rates of cardiovascular disease.
Yeah.
So it is biologically possible. The question is, can we get there? And do you think that physicians and the medical establishment as a whole are the ones to lead us there? Can one become illusioned to that goal?
Yeah, so that dovetails with one of the points I try to make in this talk, which is that scientific technologies will only go so far. And you raise a number of interesting issues, some of which I addressed in my second book, Doctored, which is over-treatment in medicine, waste, and the fact that so much of medical care is discretionary. And so when you have discretionary care, the people who provide it can decide what they want to provide. And sometimes those decisions are filtered through individual propensities, predilections, local culture, financial considerations, all these things come into play. I agree with you. Now, I think the other point you were making is that, there are societies where people live a really long time. And I'm not an expert on those societies, but what little I've read, many of them pay a lot of attention to some of the psychosocial factors that I think we increasingly will need to pay more attention to. We are living our lives on overdrive, many of us. And I know that that I was, I probably to some degree still am, but when I learned that I had coronary blockages, I immediately thought to simplify my life, simplify how I did things, my reactions to things. I'm no longer so contemptuous of relaxation. these are the things that we have to address if we want to get to Okinawa or, the Amalfi Coast, that sort of longevity that there, it's amazing there. So, that's a very good point.
So I come from it from a different point of view as a hospital social worker who covered cardiac surgery and cardiology patients. You're very enlightened as physicians go. Part of our training as social workers is exactly what you're talking about, working with patients on all these psychosocial issues. How do we, you're beginning by writing this book, which is amazing, and hopefully the medical community will read it, but how do we make that part of the training for not just cardiologists, but for residents, for medical students, to consider these issues and make it just a requirement for them, not just for cardiac patients, but for all patients. So your book is a great beginning, but how do we make this part of the...
So I don't have a easy solution to that. I think it's a marathon, and we have to make slow progress. But, you know, one thing I write in my book is that when I was a cardiology fellow and learning all about the heart, for 3 years we focused on the heart as an electrical machine. We focused on the pipes. We focused on the capacitance and the resistance of the chambers, and we focused on pressure volume loops, and no one ever talked about psychosocial stress. So we have ways to go. Absolutely.
Could you comment on the link between, you've been talking about psychosocial issues, but to take it a little further and talk about the link between cardiac disease and psychiatric disorders, most especially depression, which is now considered to be a risk factor for cardiac disease, as well as patients that have cardiovascular disease being more apt to have mood disorders and depression.
Yeah, and those who have cardiovascular disease and have mood disorders tend to have much worse outcomes. That there's, you know, the focus by psychiatrists on heart disease, and I talk about this in my book, was really on the so-called type A personality. That was the big focus in the 50s and 60s. A lot of that research came out of San Francisco. And, you know, the type A man was one who, you know, clenched his jaw and had very little time for play and was tremendously focused and didn't like to lose. And a lot of people identified with that. And the idea that this high-achieving subset of the American society was prone to heart disease, that was just a very interesting and attractive concept, and it really took hold. Today, we know that the type A link hasn't really stood up to historical examination, but the link with depression and anxiety, so-called type D personalities, is very strong. And I talk about a lot of that research in my book. Now, one of the questions you asked is, or I think you implied, was would treatment of a mood disorder ameliorate heart disease? That data is finally coming in. There's very good data to suggest that that patients who take, for example, an antidepressant called citalopram, who have had heart attacks and have depression, fare better. I think the study was called Sad Heart. Previous to that, the data was really kind of all over the map. So I think it's an area, it's a very fertile area. It's one that we need to spend more time looking at. But there's a definite link between psychological disease and heart disease, for sure. So, okay, well, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.